Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Campaign number 6, The Empire Strikes Back. The Philadelphia Campaign, 1777. We pick up the story with the British Army, commanded by General William Howe, sailing down from New York City, up the Chesapeake Bay, up the Delaware River, and taking Philadelphia. While the American Army, commanded by General Washington, sits outside to the west of Philadelphia, George Washington has planned his attack, dividing his army into four columns, hoping to oust General Howe and his army from Philadelphia. It's October 2nd, 1777. Perhaps the most surprising achievement that day was that all four columns of George Washington's army arrived where they were expected, west of Philadelphia. Once the American columns arrived and the British line was collapsing, the pivot point of the battle rested on the decision made at Cliveden to surround and assault British General Musgrave's men holed up inside the house. Rather than make his own intuitive decision, George Washington held an impromptu council of war on the field. General Henry Knox insisted that the British troops inside the house had to be neutralized before continuing to drive south into Germantown, just west of Philadelphia. It was a tactically flawed decision that tied up many hundreds of men and commands that would otherwise have continued the attack and kept the British off balance. Washington's decision turned the initiative over to the British. His men under Anthony Wayne and John Sullivan, well to the front, heard firing in their rear, believed they had been outflanked, and they reversed course. During the chaotic withdrawal, Americans fired into one another. The time wasted around Cliveden outside of Germantown and the withdrawal of the two divisions in the middle of the American assault gave the British the time they needed to regroup. The well-trained veteran British troops pushed back the confused and inexperienced Continentals, regained the lost ground, freed Musgrave's men from Cliveden, and drove the Americans off the field. The rank-and-file Americans did their duty and performed heroically. Once again, the choices made at the highest levels failed them. Just as poor intelligence had doomed the Americans at the prior battle at Brandywine, poor tactical decisions did the same at Germantown outside Philadelphia. Ultimately, George Washington failed the army. The army did not fail him. Philadelphia was now firmly in the grasp of the British, and it's October of 1777. Washington was no longer in a position to recapture it or drive the British away from the colonial capital. His strategy turned instead to starving British General Howe out of the colonial capital. Nearly everything Howe's army needed, including military and medical supplies and food, was stored in the holds of British ships, stuck downriver from Philadelphia near Chester, Pennsylvania, on the Delaware River. The Royal Navy was still unable to navigate the Delaware. Several rows of Cheval de Frise ships blocked the ships from ascending the river, as did the American Forts Mercer on the New Jersey side of the Delaware and Fort Mifflin on the Pennsylvania shore on Mud Island. Forts Mifflin and Mercer were crucial components of Washington's strategy to tighten the logistical noose around Philadelphia and the British ensconced there. On October 7th, the same day that British General John Burgoyne lost the Second Battle of Saratoga in upstate New York, British engineers began erecting batteries along the Pennsylvania shore of Providence Island north of Fort Mifflin. The Continental Army, meanwhile, had no choice but to remain north of Philadelphia to prevent British General Howe from launching excursions against American supply depots in the Pennsylvania backcountry, which meant the naval elements and river forts had to keep the British fleet below the Cheval de Frise. Despite the importance of the Delaware River operations, Washington's subordinates had thus far done little to slow the efforts of British engineers intent on taking Fort Mifflin on the Delaware. Creating the necessary gun platforms was more difficult than the British anticipated because the Americans had cut the dikes on Province and Carpenter's Islands and created knee-deep, swamp-like conditions precisely where the platforms were most needed. The only viable place to build them was on the dikes themselves, which were more exposed to enemy fire. Conditions in Fort Mifflin, held by the Americans on Mud Island, were nearly as bad for the Americans as laboring on flooded Province Island was for the British Army. The island was cold and damp, and the men were poorly equipped. The British, who erected four batteries along the dikes of Province and Carpenter's Islands, officially opened the siege of Fort Mifflin, held by the Americans, on October 15th. British General Howe was losing his patience with the slow progress along the Delaware River. He realized that more than ships were needed to assault the Americans at Fort Mercer in New Jersey. The change in strategy signaled the end of the occupation of Germantown, Pennsylvania. In order to free up troops for the Mercer operation, on October 19th, General Howe withdrew his British units from the battle-scarred village and concentrated his army back in Philadelphia. Howe intended to winter there and wanted his men safely in the city before winter set in. He also intended to personally supervise operations along the Delaware River. Once the Germantown garrison moved into Philadelphia, Howe had 18,000 military personnel in need of food and other supplies. If the river remained closed much longer, the population faced a very real prospect of starvation. Despite their strength and their victory at Germantown, the Crown forces were in a noose, and Washington's forces kept tightening the rope through harassment. Both army commanders were aware that Forts Mifflin and Mercer depended upon one another to control passage along the Delaware River. The loss of one fort would necessarily lead to the fall of the remaining fort. It had become imperative for the British to break the river blockade. With Fort Mifflin already under partial bombardment, General Howe decided to launch an attack against Fort Mercer. The all-German assault force was led by Carl von Dunlop. Up to this point in the campaign, the German troops had done very little. By midday on October 22nd, British General Dunlop arrived in the vicinity of Fort Mercer held by the Americans. After attempting to force the surrender of the fort, Dunlop launched an assault on the earthworks. The German Hessian soldiers were bloodily repulsed. Colonel von Dunlop was severely wounded in the thigh, a wound from which he would die later on October 29th. The victory for the Americans was shockingly lopsided. Apparently overcome with depression, British General William Howe wrote a letter of resignation on October 22nd. The British King accepted Howe's resignation on February 4, 1778. Having led two successful campaigns that had not led to total victory against the Americans and lacking full support from England, General Howe was disgusted and ready to head home. Washington continued to maintain a death grip on Philadelphia, hoping to starve out the British occupiers just as he had done in Boston. On October 26th, another Northeaster slammed into the region, flooding the camps of both armies and turning the Delaware and the Schuylkill Rivers into raging torrents. Mud Island and Fort Mifflin, held by the Americans, were flooded, with much of the island being under 2 feet of water. In the midst of all the despair in the British camps, General Howe received confirmation of British General John Burgoyne's surrender to the Americans up in Saratoga. On November 2, 1777, Washington's army moved forward to White Marsh and encamped. The army was positioned on a series of hills. For the next month, the armies settled into a lull that included a constant string of guerrilla engagements in no man's lands. All reports from Philadelphia indicated that the population was on the verge of starvation and that the Army never had more than 2 days' provisions on hand at any time. After the river froze, even this trickle of provisions would cease. Fort Mifflin started to take a beating, and the Americans suffered. The palisades were shattered, and the barracks were rendered useless. Colonists began huddling under the western wall. Despite this, the garrison appeared tenacious to British General Howe. But the British were having their own problems. Suffering was widespread among the British troops. Provisions, clothing, and firewood were in short supply. Many horses had succumbed to the hard work in the heavy mud and cold weather without pasture or grain. As dawn broke on November 16th, the American flag was still flying above Fort Mifflin, but no troops remained within its ruins. The British sent a detachment to the work, removed the American flag, and raised a British standard. The river was finally quiet. Fort Mercer would also be abandoned in short order by the Americans. Washington's army was in desperate condition and unable to sustain the two river forts on the Delaware. The campaign had worn down the men and the materials beyond their limits. The army had marched over 400 miles, and supplies were trickling in from New England and Virginia, with New York and Philadelphia cut off. With the river finally open, British supplies began to flow into Philadelphia. General Howe determined to launch one last offensive against the Americans. On December 5th, 1777, he led 10,000 British troops in two columns out from Philadelphia. Howe determined that attacking the American position on its series of hills would not prove advantageous. Rather, Howe opted for a flanking movement towards Cheltenham Township and Jerkintown. The march was conducted during the night of December 6th, and the British moved to position near Edge Hill. On the morning of December 7th, Howe's men marched to the top of Edge Hill. After pushing the American militia and riflemen back, Howe halted and looked across the valley to the main American line on the White Marsh Hills. The line appeared well-trenched and fortified, with 50 artillery pieces looking down at him. General Washington showed no signs of coming down off the hills. Having failed to draw Washington out from his encampment, Howe returned to Philadelphia the next day. Washington did learn a lesson from the fighting around White Marsh. His army was too close to Philadelphia, and both of his flanks were vulnerable to the British. By mid-December, campaigning was quickly coming to a close. A discussion occurred between Washington and several of his officers over where a winter encampment should be located. Wilmington, Lancaster, and Reading in Pennsylvania were suggested. However, moving farther away from the British Army in Philadelphia would open more of the region to depredations and increase local support for the British. Staying close to Philadelphia to deter Howe, but far enough away to avoid surprises, was a more probable political and military solution. Thus, on the morning of December 19th, George Washington's army marched into their Valley Forge encampment, 18 miles from Philadelphia. Howe's army officially went into winter quarters on December 30th. Things did not look good for the American army and the American cause. Nevertheless, the future would see the transformation of the Continental Army at the hands of Baron von Steuben in the winter quarters in Valley Forge. The army that marched out of Valley Forge the following spring would go on to fight competently at Monmouth and ultimately force the surrender of the British Army at Yorktown in 1781. This concludes Campaign Number 6, The Empire Strikes Back, the Philadelphia Campaign of 1777. We now begin Campaign Number 7, the Monmouth, New Jersey Campaign, June 1778. Tactical draw, political victory. News of the former alliance between France and the rebellious American colonies reached the Continental Army at Valley Forge in Pennsylvania on May 3, 1778. For General George Washington, the Army's hard-pressed commander-in-chief, the event was literally a matter of divine intervention. "The Almighty Ruler of the Universe," Washington proclaimed, had raised up a powerful friend among the princes of the earth to establish our liberty and independence. Washington ordered a day of thanksgiving with a parade, cheers for French King Louis XVI, artillery salutes, and no doubt to the soldiers' delight, a special issue of rum. Word of the alliance was the best news Washington had received in months. In occupying Philadelphia, news of the Franco-American alliance caused no rejoicing. In fact, early 1778 found British military fortunes problematic. Parliament had learned of the enemy alliance in late February 1778 and considered it tantamount to a declaration of war by France. This development, along with growing tensions with Spain and Holland, had raised the possibility of wider hostilities. Britain lacked the resources to fight everywhere, and the ministry in London understood that new operations in the American North were unlikely to be decisive. Thus, British Lord George Germain, the American secretary, ordered the new British commander-in-chief, Lieutenant General Sir Henry Clinton, who had relieved General William Howe in May, to evacuate Philadelphia. The orders staggered British morale, but General Clinton was to return his army to New York. The British were not giving up. They planned to redeploy many of Clinton's men in a new effort in the American South, where they hoped for significant Loyalist support and to bolster their garrisons in Florida and the valuable Caribbean Sugar Islands. The British would also keep a worried eye on Europe. Thus, what had begun as a colonial rebellion had become part of a much broader struggle, all of which meant that Clinton could expect no significant reinforcements in New York. Clinton had intended to leave Philadelphia via the Delaware River. The Royal Navy, however, lacked the shipping to carry his troops in the throngs of frightened Tories who preferred flight to remaining in Philadelphia. Clinton therefore assigned the sick and wounded, military dependents, Loyalist civilians, and some Hessian regiments to the available ships. The rest of his army, some 13,000 men and camp followers, prepared for an overland march across New Jersey. As much as General Clinton resented his orders to retreat, he planned to make the best of his trek. With any luck, he would find a way to draw Washington into a showdown fight. After loading transports and moving advance units and equipment to a New Jersey bridgehead, Clinton's army completed its crossing on June 18th. Shortly thereafter, the transports dropped down the Delaware. In New Jersey, Clinton struck northeast. The stage for the Monmouth, New Jersey campaign was set. While British General Clinton began his march, George Washington was at Valley Forge, ready to give chase. In fact, Washington was only too happy to leave the winter encampment behind, as it held no fond memories. Valley Forge had been an ordeal. Logistical and fiscal failures, disease, and bouts of miserable weather had brought the American army to the brink of collapse. Washington's reverses in combat in late 1777, including the loss of the de facto rebel capital of Philadelphia, had ignited a storm of criticism of his leadership. Indeed, there was a concerted effort among some in Congress, the so-called Conway Cabal, to curtail Washington's authority as commander-in-chief, if not to replace him with Major General Horatio Gates, the victor at Saratoga, New York. Yet Valley Forge had been a redemptive experience. Washington displayed considerable political finesse in outmaneuvering his critics, and the timely arrival of French arms, equipment, and other military aid had allowed the general to re-equip and reorganize his Continentals. The appointments of Jeremiah Wadsworth and Nathanael Greene as commissary and quartermaster generals, respectively, had vastly improved logistics operations. Moreover, the labors of Frederick von Steuben as inspector general had retrained the regulars in a common disciplinary and tactical regimen. By June 1778, the result of all these changes was an army better in most every respect than the force that had straggled into Valley Forge in December 1777. How much better, however, and how it would do against Clinton's veterans remained to be seen. Washington could only guess at British intentions. Before Clinton left Philadelphia, the commander-in-chief had already dispatched General William Maxwell's New Jersey Brigade into New Jersey. Now he hoped that Maxwell and state militia might slow British General Clinton enough for the American Continentals to catch him. When the British actually crossed the Delaware, however, their rebel chief reacted cautiously. In May, a council of war had agreed to adopt a defensive posture in any new campaign, reacting to enemy initiatives rather than boldly attacking. Yet on June 17th, a second council was more contentious. Some officers, including Major Generals Charles Lee and von Steuben, still unconvinced that the American Continentals could handle the British regulars, urged continued caution. Other officers, including Green, Lafayette, and Anthony Wayne, argued for bringing Clinton to battle. Washington decided on a middle ground. He would shadow the British, stay out of trouble, and hope for an opportunity to strike. His advance units left Valley Forge on the 19th and crossed into New Jersey on the 20th. The campaign was on. Washington's quarry, the British, was in no hurry. Clinton's soldiers plodded through excessive heat and torrential rains over sandy roads, all the while tormented by swarming mosquitoes. Their accordion-like baggage trains, loaded with tons of supplies, occasionally stretched almost 12 miles long. The British columns moved on high alert as rebel detachments hovered on their flanks, destroying bridges, blocking roads, and searching for ambush opportunities. The threat increased when Washington sent Daniel Morgan's riflemen to support Maxwell and the militia. After skirmishing with the Americans at Crosswicks on June 23rd, Clinton arrived at Allentown on June 24th. He had marched only 40 miles in a week. But adverse weather and the Americans had little to do with General Clinton's torpid advance. In fact, the British commander was deliberately taking his time, hoping against hope that Washington would come up and offer battle. And by June 24th, intelligence reports had alerted Washington to Clinton's intentions. At Allentown, two routes lay open to Clinton. One tracked northeast through Brunswick, New Jersey, and on to Perth Amboy, where he could cross to British-held Staten Island, New York. The other, the southerly route, led through the village of Monmouth Courthouse, also known as Freehold, and on to Sandy Hook, New York. From there, the Royal Navy could ferry the Army to New York. Clinton elected to take the road to Sandy Hook. He feared that heading for New Brunswick would offer Washington a chance to hit his baggage train as it forded the Raritan River. Significantly, Clinton also hoped that easier terrain toward Freehold would favor him if Washington chose to fight. Thus, on the morning of June 25, 1778, the British Army left Allentown for Monmouth Courthouse, where they arrived the following day. While Clinton moved deeper into New Jersey, Washington pondered his next move. By the 24th of June, the Americans had reached Hopewell. Barely 20 miles now separated the armies. Learning of Clinton's move towards Freehold, Washington considered striking at least part of the retreating army. Another council of war, however, revealed little consensus among his American generals. The Hawks argued for hitting Clinton hard, although without precipitating a general engagement, that is, without committing the entire Continental Army. If we sever the enemy to pass through New Jersey without attacking, General Greene warned, I think we shall regret it. People expect something from us, and our strength demands it. I am by no means for rash measures, he concluded, but we must preserve our reputation. It was a political argument aimed at restoring popular faith in Washington and the Army after the disappointments of 1777. Other officers, however, supported the contrary views of Major General Charles Lee of the Americans. a British veteran with considerable experience. Lee was the Army's second-ranking officer. Competent early in the war, Lee had become critical of Washington during the defeats of late 1776. A British patrol had captured Lee in December, but Lee was exchanged and rejoined the Army only weeks before Clinton evacuated Philadelphia. Lee had little faith in Washington's regulars. Continentals, he warned, would prove no match for redcoat professionals. Lee argued for letting Clinton go, arguing that there is no need to risk the American Army. Wouldn't it be better, Lee asked, to wait French intervention while preserving American strength? Lee insisted that a Patriot victory in New Jersey would mean little, while a serious defeat could do irreversible harm. We should note that despite the pall cast over his career after Monmouth, and more on that later, Lee's ideas had merit. Rebel spirits had soared at news of the French alliance and the British evacuation of Philadelphia, and Clinton wanted nothing more than to lure Washington into a showdown fight. He looked to pounce on any mistake the American general made, and Lee wanted to avoid just such an eventuality. Reading about Campaign Number 7, the Monmouth, New Jersey Campaign, June 1778, Tactical Draw, Political Victory, in The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, will continue. This is Wallace Klinghast, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.